On this episode of Skeptico,
I hear love and light being what it's really about. I hear it being moralistic and being hierarchical, and that the materialistic, even the spiritual materialism of trying to get ahead, of trying to get something out of the enchantment or the spell, is really just, at the very least, treading water. It's not really moving you towards this spiritual growth that ultimately is what it's all about. What do you make of that as a general idea?
I think I know exactly what you mean. The question is philosophical in the human sense, which is morality a objective category of the universe like spin or something in physics? And that I don't think people have ever solved. So I don't know. Is morality an inherent category in the universe? And as a result, should that shape your actions in this life? Probably, but it's an eternal question, essentially.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. You might have noticed I slipped a new word in there to the introduction in terms of spirituality. I know many of these shows over the last year have drifted away from pure science, if you will, and more into the topic of spirituality, as today's show does, and as the last episode of Skeptico did as well. So I thought I'd offer just a bit of an explanation for that. First off, the show has really always been about spirituality, because if you're going to look at science's big picture questions, who are we, why are we here, you very quickly get to all the spiritual questions. I mean, you have to deal with some of the sciencey stuff, and we've certainly done that on the show and will continue to do it, but you don't have to dig very far until you get into the spiritual stuff. And that's a major focus of this episode, as it was with the last episode. But I do feel a need to address the religious issue a little bit. You know, with the last episode of Skeptico, I did get a number of comments from people on the forum and emails about quote-unquote Christian bashing. And this is nothing new. I get this whenever I do a show about Christianity and whenever we talk about biblical history, which, as I just kind of mentioned, I mean, I don't know how you do a Skeptico-style show about spirituality and not talk about biblical history and not do this thing where you try and cut through what's real and what isn't. So there's, in some respects, no getting around that. But in another way, I totally get the Christian bashing criticism. As I shared on this show, my wife and I made a conscious decision to go back to the Christian church, the nice little liberal Solana Beach Presbyterian church that's right down the corner here in Southern California and is just about as mainstream as you can get. We went back. We went back for the reason that a lot of people go back, for the kids, because we had kids and we wanted to have some balance against this crazy secular do what thou wilt mentality that's pervasive in our culture and in particular here in Southern California. So we went back, we sat in the pews, we ponied up our tithing, and we listened. And a lot of what we heard, we liked. We liked that they cared about other people. We liked that they were engaged in the community. We liked that they preached a message of love and acceptance. But we just couldn't get past the craziness. We couldn't get past the need to cling to a lot of stuff that we all know just isn't true. So we eventually made the decision to just stop going. So when I hear people talk about Christian bashing, what I hear is folks saying, you know what, I've made a conscious decision to be a part of this community, to accept the good along with the bad, and to move forward with some people who are basically trying to do good things, trying to move their spirituality and their relationship with that higher power forward in a positive way. And I totally get that. But that's not what this show is about. This show is about continuing to follow the data wherever it leads. So if the data leads towards the New Testament having strong elements of a power control, mind control vehicle, then we go there until the evidence leads us a different way. If the evidence points towards the Old Testament taking a local thunder god like Yahweh and elevating him to some higher position and breaking off Satan to make him look better, well, then that's where we go. And if the data leads towards calling out occult practitioners and magic practitioners as buying into the same biblical silliness that they seem to be opposing, well, then that's where we go as well. And that's the thought that I had in my head when I sat down with author of Pieces of Eight and non-practicing chaos magician Gordon White for the second part of this interview on the long shadow of Christianity. Hope you enjoy it. Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. Now, on the last episode of Skeptico, I promised to deliver to you Gordon White to talk about his new book, Pieces of Eight. And, well, Gordon, are you there?
That I am, Alex.
Oh, there was just enough of a pause there. I wish you would have paused a little bit later. We could have had a cliffhanger. So, Gordon, it's great to have you here. Again, some listeners will remember that you joined me in March to talk about your terrific book, Starships. You also wrote another book in 2016 that we didn't have you on to talk about, titled The Chaos Protocols. But then you did return again in August of this year, and you just did a terrific job of helping us out with an interview with Dr. John Brandenburg that I know a lot of people really found interesting and challenging at the same time. So I was worried that people might have gotten enough of Gordon White, but when I saw this latest book and I got my hands on it, Pieces of Eight, I just couldn't resist. It's a terrific book. Tell people really quickly, briefly, an overview of what Pieces of Eight is all about and how it fits into this, I don't know how you do it, but this body of work that you've produced in the last year.
It's possible I look more prolific than I actually am. Those first two, so Starships and the Chaos Protocols, is actually both of them were completed about this time last year. Obviously, just because they were published with traditional publishers, there's a delay. So I sort of had 9 months to do Pieces of Eight, and it looks like I'm manically writing like it's a movie about Mozart. But I promise you, the books are, you know, they take a book amount of time, and the most recent one, Pieces of Eight, is a collection of short essays and kind of practical enchantments specifically geared around, I guess, giving a sort of bellows breath to a chaos magic worldview. The other two books are written by a practicing magician or by a practicing chaos magician, but aren't actually about chaos magic. This one effectively is my chaos magic book.
Well, it's great. In the last episode of Skeptico, I gave folks a little bit of a sense of it when I played a clip for the interview you did and an excellent interview you gave with Miguel Connor, where you talk about materialism, you know, and consciousness research, basically, that we talk so much about on this show. So, I think people will be a little bit off when they hear this guy's talking about chaos magic. And then what's this clip we heard about consciousness research? So your understanding of a magical worldview and how that intersects with science and how that intersects with culture, I think is a lot broader than most people, I guess, if they're not familiar with your work, would appreciate. What are some of the areas that you touch on in Pieces of Eight?
Well, it certainly opens with kind of Goldilocksing our way through kind of different models of reality, the main ones being materialism, which doesn't work. And then we start to move on to ones that I like less, but are slightly better than materialism. So we have panpsychism, which is essentially a fudge to kind of keep materialism in the game. And then we have idealism. So the idea that everything is the kind of one mind, that's in there, and I like that well enough. I think it describes reality certainly better than panpsychism or materialism, but it's in that Goldilocks sense not quite right. It struggles to, or it bends rather than breaks, a model when you come to deal with sort of high strange phenomena, magic, UFOs, and so on. And so it kind of then explores this idea of a return of animism to what I call the philosophical big table, where it animism has been a very popular idea for the last 20 years within, say, ecological circles or post-colonial indigenous politics circles, and that's all well and good. I don't see a lot of people.
What does it mean in those circles? Because I think it has a little bit of a different meaning in those circles than it does in the magic occult circles world. And you do a nice job of kind of defining those differences and similarities.
It sort of means the same thing. As a broad term, a broad description of animism would be, well, I call it a spirit-haunted universe, but in the kind of political speak, it is that humans aren't the only persons. Right. There are non-human persons. They can be sacred mountains. They can be plants. They can be ancestors. And it's sort of decentralizing or democratizing personhood. And you can make the very good case that it's our kind of aberrant view of personhood that we've got in a kind of post-Christian, post-Descartes world that has sort of imbalanced people both mentally and quite messed with the environment. So it's good in that political sense, but again, and there's a lot of value that comes out of people discussing it in that sort of sphere. They do still tend to stop short of the things that I think, and we've had this discussion before, the things that change everything,
right?
Which is the, you know, UFOs and spirit phenomena and NDEs and so on, which fall perfectly into an animist model. They don't even touch the sides, but they're left. And I appreciate the politics involved of kind of working with indigenous cultures and that kind of stuff. But nevertheless, these indigenous cultures are not only think a tree is a person, they also believe in the objective reality of their ancestor spirits. And I don't know. And I think that needs to be kind of pushed a bit more.
Pushed a bit more in what direction? Not like kind of reclaiming the reality of that and the usefulness of that in modern day culture, right? I mean, I think that's one of the things you say in the Chaos Protocols that I thought was really great and practical advice is go build an altar to your ancestors. Now, for the majority of the world's population, that's not news. But, you know, for Westerners, that's like, oh, what kind of crazy idea is that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think in the kind of metaphoric context of having or giving animism a seat at the big table of philosophical ideas, it can say, you know, these spirits have an objective reality. What have you got? Because if you go around the table, materialism has nothing. Panpsychism has nothing with some sparkles. And idealism tells you you're correct in a way, but you're also in error in how you see and experience these spirits. So it struggles with the kind of phenomenological approach. It doesn't model or value the experience of the experiencer as highly as animism does. And I think whether it's right or not, because I'm very interested in it as an explanatory model rather than a belief system I like, even though I happen to, and I'll abandon it if it doesn't work. But I don't think it's been given a run, and it's kind of like your car keys. The model we're looking for may be in the last place we look, and it seems like if you try to fold in all the sort of Fortean phenomena and psi effects and all this kind of stuff back into a model that is satisfactory at describing things, to me right now, I think that looks like animism.
Quickly, a brief overview of some of the other topics, areas that people will find in Pieces of Eight.
Sure. So it kind of starts there, and then it runs through topics that have a kind of cornerstone ideas within a modern Western occult perspective. So it talks about the role of God or how God could be satisfactorily kind of conceived. It has to do with how we model initiation and experience place and all the kind of pieces that go into, hence the title, all the kind of pieces that go into operating in a magical worldview. So there's some history in there. There's the value of there's the value of being suspicious of power in that kind of conspiratainment sense, all those sort of pieces that go into what I think is the kind of most efficiently running occult worldview, if you will.
It really is awesome. I mean, for me, it's just totally engaging, and I just can't get enough of it, even though I have to kind of sip it. But the reason I wanted you to kind of sketch it out, because as people know who listened to the last episode of Skeptico, I wanted to kind of take things in a slightly different direction. Your book has been out for a couple months, and you've given some excellent, excellent interviews on it. I referenced Miguel Connor. That's a really good one. You and Greg Carlwood do a really nice job of it on the Higher Side Chats, and there's other ones out there as well. So I wanted to try and do something a little bit different, because as I was reading of Pieces of Eight, I couldn't help but feel that in a way it was intersecting with some of the stuff that we had been stumbling across here on Skeptico. And that's why I prepared the last episode of Skeptico and kind of said, hey, there's some other things that are really kind of big, big boulders that seem to be lying in the middle of the road that we kind of carefully drive around sometimes, and let's just kind of tackle them head on. And you do tackle some aspects of those head on, but I wanted to approach it in a different way. So are you up for that?
Sounds great.
I knew you'd say that. That's why I called. I knew I could count on you. So one of the things I sketched out in the last episode is trying to wrap our arms around the Christianity thing again, because I think it does loom so large in these discussions. It's always there behind the curtain, or sometimes it's not even behind the curtain. Sometimes it's out front and center, but it pops up in some strange ways. And I tried to lay those out in the last episode of Skeptico when I tried to sketch out this idea that we can only understand the early history of Christianity if we look at it from a conspiratorial point of view, because that's how it seems to play out. Now, I first have to ask you, what do you think of that? I know you're somewhat familiar with the Joe Atwell kind of view of the world, because I read a post that you have on the very excellent Rune Soup. But what do you think about the conspiratorial idea of the founding of Christianity?
I think we're sort of in agreement. I like Joe Atwell's stuff. I think we're in agreement about this, having had discussions that weren't recorded, Alex, that Joe Atwell found a hammer and all of Christian history looks like a nail. And I think he is he's completely correct in matching the Titus's military campaigns to the story of in the Gospels and all that kind of thing. That is fine. I don't think it's a sufficient explanation for Christianity, given that you can, and I sort of do make the case that Christianity starts before the purported birth of someone who never physically existed. I mean, when you say we can't get our head around Christianity without its origins without conspiracy, that's correct. But the other part of it is the sort of magical and philosophical renaissance that was going on in the Eastern Mediterranean at the time. So the God that comes to be in the sort of early or the dark ages of Christianity for educated people isn't Jewish. It's Greco-Egyptian Jewish. So it's when he's very good at kind of unpicking the stories of the Gospels and how they match to the needs of the Roman Empire. But the idea of a logos and personal redemption and all these ideas were kicking around in a parade of different spiritual cults at the time. So what I think Titus did was weaponize one of them. But the message is there.
I agree with you on the mixing and merging of different traditions, lines of thought, and all the rest of that. Where I think is the important distinction, though, is that once we go down the conspiratorial path and understand that this was a tool of power and control and mind manipulation as well, I don't think that ever comes out. So it keeps cropping up again and again and again. It's like, oh, we use that trick. How can we mix that in again? And it certainly went on before this period of the biblical authoring. This was an old trick of the Romans that they did with every group that they conquered, you know, just merge them in. Oh, your gods become our gods. And oh, by the way, we didn't tell you this story about our God and how he works here, but it seems particularly relevant to your situation. So why don't we just take over your stuff kind of thing?
And the Egyptians did it too. Like they were very good at mind warfare in that way.
So what is the relationship then between religion and the spiritual reality that is being tapped into? I think that's the hard part. And that's what I was getting at, in that I think we have to be really careful when the atheists jump off on one side, which is just totally insane, and say, well, the only way to handle it then is just to deny all of it, you know, and back to our materialist model and just say, you know, you're a biological robot in a meaningless universe. That's how we solve the problem. You know, there's none of it exists. And all of us have the experience that that's completely not true. But the other jumping off point in the occult world, and that's what I particularly wanted to get your opinion on, is they hold on to those same Christian myths in kind of a very strange way, where, like I said in the last episode, you know, we're now reciting the Lord's Prayer three times backwards, and, you know, Aleister Crowley is wants to poke the eyes out of Jesus on the cross because... Yeah, and let's talk about Crowley for a minute, as long as I'm ranting. I mean, the first thing I want to say is I feel tremendous empathy for anyone who was, I don't know how else you want to say it, but a victim of brainwashing, mind control like he was. I mean, the kind of strict religious upbringing that he had, you know, no Christmas, no books, would create a whole lot of rebellion from just about anybody. But I mean, I don't know how we put Crowley back together as an important occult figure in this whole thing.
I think he's getting less and less important, which is good. The better part of the 20th century, from a magical perspective, you kind of couldn't move for the amount of Crowley in the room. And I think he's getting back to probably a level that he would have liked, at least on his up days rather than his down days, which is, look, I gave it my best shot. I walked the walk. I mountain climbed. I went to Egypt to channel gods. I took all these drugs. I had all kinds of sex. Like, I walked the walk. But you kind of like his whole worldview is him specific. And he does say that in his later years. He does say, the thing I hope people get from me is like, my worldview is only going to be important to me. I hope they get that there is a way to do this. There is a way that you can kind of, reanimate and redeem your own world by doing this. And so that's where I think Crowley's at. I think where he's kind of declining in the discourse, to not vanishing, but sort of leveling off to a more healthy perspective on him. So, I mean, I quite like him for that sort of, you know, late Victorian, early Edwardian, you know, sex poet kind of Oscar Wilde style, but, you know, angrier.
Well, I think a lot of people, including myself, can identify with the iconoclastic, rebellious kind of part of it. But what I'm trying to sort out is, how do we understand what's really going on? I mean, that's such a huge question, but how do we understand what the proper relationship is between us and this spirit world? And I think we try and hold out all these examples. And when I run across Crowley, I just say, this is an example of how not to do it. You know, I somehow or another stumbled into the yogic tradition a long time ago. And one of the things I took away from that is, you know, these people thought about it pretty deeply for a long time. I think of the first thing on Patanjali's Eight Limbs of Yoga, and it's the yamas. It's the, you got to be a decent human being. You know, if you're not a decent human being, then don't even start down the path. And it seems to me like Crowley, because he was in this completely bizarre Christian cult thing. His rebellion caused him to just kind of lose common sense, and he's in this opposite mode, you know, like SpongeBob, opposite day. You know, well, let's just do the opposite of everything. You know, whatever pops in our mind, we just do it. I mean, in your book, in the Chaos Protocols, you have some very practical advice for people who are trying to manage this world. You talk about meditation. You talk about cleansing. You even talk about, you know, diet and cleansing your body. These are completely at odds with what Crowley's saying about just, well, whatever random idea pops in your head, just follow whatever that monkey mind says we should follow. I just don't think it's very good advice on how to navigate this spirit world.
Well, it's not. But in Crowley's defense, I appear to be defending him now. He probably spends more time talking about the benefits of yoga and meditation than any of the other stuff. I mean, he traveled across Asia doing that. You know, he meditated in India. He did yoga pretty much his entire life. So he was, and in fact, his descriptions of yoga in Magic and Theory and Practice are probably the only bit that have kind of stood well. They have stood the test of time better than any of the other stuff he said. So I agree completely. I'm not sure if I think in how he would have conceptualized that is that he deemed himself enlightened somewhere along the way. And one of the things Crowley said is that the Buddha should have known better. And by that he means once you kind of realize that this that reality is not as advertised. In Crowley's conception of it, you're essentially free. Like you can behave. There is no inherent morality in the universe, and you've kind of seen through that illusion. I'm not sure if the universe has an inherent morality, but I agree that I don't think that's probably not a best practice way of achieving that kind of psychic or spiritual health.
I would agree. And I think that message of that, I mean, because to a certain extent, that's a very non-dual message. I mean, you can go over to the non-dual community and you can kind of hear that same thing. Easier heard from someone who's chosen a path of goodness, denial of material, worldly kind of things. Much easier to hear from that person than from someone who has an insatiable appetite for all these things that are completely about this world. You know, I mean, there is kind of an inherent mismatch there that I just don't see occult people really coming to grips with, in the same way, I guess, that sometimes I don't see atheists coming to grips with the silliness of a proposition that, well, we're really nothing and we really don't have free will. So let me tell you how angry I am about God, you know?
Yeah, potentially. I'm not sure how strawman that is. I mean, we do. You'll find occultists misbehaving as you find anyone else. You certainly won't find them. Let's move further up the decision tree. When you're talking about Crowley's behavior, there's almost a materialist kind of structure to your thinking there, which is that the physical is bad versus the non-physical, which is good, which is very post-Descartes Western European. And in his cosmology, so if you look in the Book of the Law, you know, all acts of love and joy are my rituals. The physical exists for the experience of joy, and in that connection, you get a connection with the full universe. So that's kind of where he's going with it. But when we come to the sort of morality about whether this one is objectively better than the other, if we move back up the decision tree, again, this is where I think animism is quite good to table ideas. The spirit world in animistic cosmologies is amoral. And in fact, Graham Harvey, who's kind of one of the more prominent animist intellectuals or academics, in his research in, say, the Maori in New Zealand, when they go into the forest or when they engage with the spirit world, it is to achieve the same morality and optionality of the gods to kill with impunity. So hunting and cutting down trees are amoral acts. The gods do it The spirits do it, and the magical rituals are designed to give that same amoral capacity, so as to feed a family and build a waka. And there's quite a sophisticated way of, rather than going good and evil, which we got and isn't really inherent in Christianity's DNA either. It's sort of something that we get from, I guess, the middle ages on as being important. But that kind of dualism doesn't work very well. And there's a kind of nuance to saying, well, the gods are amoral, or the spirit world is amoral in the sense we think that means behaving negatively. It means to operate without morality. And there's probably some value in looking at it in that direction.
I think I see where you're coming from, and I understand that. I guess I'm really asking, is the scant bit of evidence that we get from here and there as we put it together and put it on the table like you're doing, and I totally respect how you are doing it, because I think you're approaching it in the same spirit that I am, of just trying to figure this thing out the best we can. But does that really fit? So let me toss onto that table, for example, the evidence from the near-death experience science that I'm so fond of, because I think it gives us kind of a pretty clean set of data to look at. And I hear love and light being what it's really about. I hear it being moralistic and being hierarchical, and that the materialistic, even the spiritual materialism of trying to get ahead, of trying to get something out of the enchantment or the spell, is really just, at the very least, treading water. Even if it's amoral, it's not really moving you towards this spiritual growth that ultimately is what it's all about. What do you make of that as a general idea?
I think I know exactly what you mean, and it reminds me of something that Graham Hancock said, which is that anyone who would like to hold a high office should go and do 2 weeks with ayahuasca, because they're a lot less psychopathic once you've had an encounter with the reality of the spirit world. And I know exactly what you mean. The question is philosophical in the human sense, which is morality a objective category of the universe, like spin or something in physics? And that I don't think people have ever solved. And I think the NDE research, you're correct. I think in the end, and it's, you kind of hear it in a muddled way coming through Crowley's Book of the Lore, because it basically says, this is just shadows. The universe is joy. So I don't know. The short answer is I don't know. Is morality an inherent category in the universe? And as a result, should that shape your actions in this life? Probably. Because the other side of the argument, this is usually where I land with it, the other side of the argument is, if it isn't, if morality is not like spin or any of the kind of sort of four physics forces that that are inherent in the universe, if it's not like that, then the only morality that exists is the one that we impart onto the universe by operating in a moral way. And that seems to me a reasonably good reason for doing so. So I don't know. I think if the universe does have an inherent morality, it's probably not as basic as follow these 10 commandments. There's probably kind of longer, almost Taoist games and interactions with how that might play out. But it's an eternal question, essentially.
Play along with me then. Let's leave morality right where you put it. Another element of the universe's physics, like spin. What does that say about evil then? What is evil? This has come up just several times in the last few episodes. I sent you a link of the interview that I did with fellow Llewellyn author Dr. Jane Kent, who, when I asked her about her practice with the goddess and shamanism, and we got to talking about evil, and she was quite emphatic in saying, yes, evil exists. You have to protect yourself. And anyone who thinks they can just kind of go into this spirit world and try and interact with it willy-nilly is just opening themselves up for all kinds of potential harm. Most of us have a sense that that is true, even if we're not sure exactly how and why. We have a sense that there's a reality to that as well. First off, let me ask you, what did you make of that comment by Jane Kent? Do you agree with that? Has that been your experience?
I frankly don't agree with it, because it's a subset of the question we just asked. Because if evil has an evil probably has an objective reality, like an external physical reality, if the universe is inherently moral, like if it has a morality as part of its physics, then yes. But her examples of the one you just gave there is confusing evil with causing harm. There are some scary, bad, not having your best interests at heart entities, you know, out there in the world, embodied or not. And that is
embodied or not. Right.
Yes. And that's absolutely, you know, that seems like a perfectly reasonable thing to say. The catch is whether that is a capital E evil. And I don't think she's thought through the sort of physics implications of what we just said, which is, for her saying that, she is pinning her colors to the wall that the universe does have an objective morality. And it might, but I think she needs to kind of maybe clear up her thinking herself there, because there are certainly bad things out there and things that like you, things that don't, things that are ambivalent. That sort of ambivalence, amorality, is a sort of resting state feature of an animist conception of the spirit world. And the best example of that would be the devil in early modern sort of Northwestern European characterization. The devil is something created by God. So it is part of the system. The kind of dualism that people in sort of modern day America that have emerged from those kind of CIA funded ecstatic churches, isn't there. Like, the devil kind of bothers your crops. He's not there he's not in some kind of casino counting up souls against God. It's a force in the universe. It's one you don't worship, but it is one that has uses, as does everything else in God's creation. And that's really how you get to the conception of the devil within a sort of lesser educated European magical perspective in the past. Does that mean that evil has an objective reality? I'm not sure if it does. I think it just means the devil exists, because let's be honest, the bad guy in the Old Testament is God. And I think these kind of, you know, Portuguese grandmothers in the 1600s knew that.
That's why I tried to make the connection in the last episode, and I don't know that I fully did, but between what Joe Atwell is saying about the New Testament and what biblical scholar Richard Smalley is telling us about the history of God, because I found that incredibly revealing, where he says, look, if you really go back and look at the history of the Old Testament, Satan is created as the evil twin of Yahweh, not as evil twin. Yahweh has good and bad. You know, he's just the thunder god up there. Some days he's good, some days he's happy, some days he's bad. And then they change the script. They go, you know, this isn't so good. If we're really going to elevate Yahweh to be the guy, we really don't want him doing these bad things. Let's create this other guy, Satan, over here, and we'll just put all the bad stuff on him. And I think Smalley makes a case that you can just follow the texts and the older ones to the newer ones, and they're rewriting the same stories where Yahweh did this stuff, and now all of a sudden Satan's doing it. So to me, that's pretty compelling evidence that maybe that Satan thing wasn't really what we thought it was either.
But you can also see a progression there from the animist conception of amorality, which is in the earliest text, God is doing both, to a kind of emerging dualism as the centuries progress and different ideas cross-pollinate around the Eastern Mediterranean. But at the bottom, the Maori see the spirit world the same way the kind of early Israelite conceptions of God were. God is a force. And when God is doing things like causing plagues. It's not necessarily Satan, as like Azazel is probably God in a bad mood. So it is another one of those. It's probably the other side of a very early conception of Yahweh. It's that kind of when Yahweh's in grumpy mode, he's Azazel. And this, a similar thing would happen with Satan. But if you roll that all the way back up to the beginning, what you have is essentially what the Maoris told Graham Harvey about: we do these rituals so that we can act the same way as the gods. We can essentially behave with impunity, with and that kind of, there we have it again. There we have potentially a lack of morality as an inherent category in the universe. We have a spirit world that is, you know, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose.
Well, I like the way you put it a few minutes ago when you said that these are the ultimate big, big, big questions. So, you know, here we are, two guys trying to tackle them on a podcast.
I'm sure we'll do it with the other half of the show. Yeah.
I know, exactly. But putting that aside for a minute, I mean, the thoughts that come to mind to me as I start drawing these connections is, one, I look at the Christ consciousness thing that, again, if I can reference poor Jane Kent, that I have to hold out there and hold her up and then take another swing with the pinata. But, you know, this idea that she had such a hard time with Christ consciousness because she was convinced that the mythicist position, that is, that Jesus of the Bible, that single solitary character, never really historically existed, which I think you're sympathetic to and I'm sympathetic to as well, although I don't know. I mean, there probably was some figure out there that filled a lot of those characteristics, but certainly as the Bible plays out, I mean, no one can really do all that stuff. But nonetheless, it strikes me that on one hand, the Christ consciousness thing seems to be, it is a reality. It mm-hmm. is a reality because people are encountering Christ. And yep. They're encountering Jesus of the Bible, unless we want to totally set aside those accounts, and I certainly don't. So I just wonder, are we getting some hints there from, again, these places that I like to look? I like to look in the near-death experience research because I can get my hands on that. I like to look at the medium research because I can wrap my arms around that. And here's what they're telling me. Whatever you put your mind to, you manifest inside of a real structure. So there is a real, this is my take on it, there is a real hierarchy. And what it is light. I mean, there's just light. And then there's gray, but really it's just another shade of light. So it's all going up. It's all higher and higher. There is a morality to it. And so you can tap into it. And we can create these figures like Jesus. Or on the other hand, because we all have that tendency, we can create these figures like Satan. So even if Smoley tells us Satan was created just to serve a purpose, it doesn't matter. As soon as we start worshiping Satan, we are manifesting that energy and we're shaping that energy into what it becomes. So there's a couple ideas in there, but you are going to be so much better than I am at sorting out what that means.
Well, so I had the opposite experience when encountering mythicism. I'm really surprised at the atheists who seem to think history is like the last few minutes of an episode of Scooby-Doo, where you just kind of, you know, pull the mask off and go, ha-ha, there is no Jesus. It was just the gardener. And then go, ergo, there's no God. For me, when I encountered the mythicist research, this was basically the first time in my life I became interested in Jesus, because I'm like, oh, I can get this. The stories in school that you would hear about when he's walking on water and you know, doing party tricks at a wedding, and you go, this is crap. These things didn't happen. And then with mythicism, you start to get your first look at that kind of Eastern Mediterranean philosophical soup that I mentioned earlier. I get what you're saying with the our mind will kind of conceive of and sort of refract light. It's sort of a very monist way of thinking about it. But if you look at, say, Philo of Alexandria and his idea of the Logos. And here he was essentially injecting the idea of the word of God as the animating force in the universe. In the sort of, you know, 50 BC Alexandria point, this is when they're blurring with Hermeticism and Gnostics and so on. And this is the bit that I think Joe Atwill misses. I can get my head around Jesus as the Logos, as an animating force of the universe, now that I know that I'm not expected to believe the physical stories that are not only some of them have been used as imperial propaganda, but this is the whole point of a Christian apologetics. Every beat in these stories are things that have happened in other mythologies, right? So the right. Christian apologetics had to go like, oh yeah, but that was because the devil was kind of like foreshadowing Jesus. like these kind of hilarious 150-year philosophical debates kind of give you a hint. And so my favorite one, when we talk about the Gospels, and this is, I think, maybe what nails it for me, if you ask someone like Stephen Davies, there is a case to be made that the earliest gospel is, in fact, the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas. Yes, so it's not Mark, it's not any of them, it's Thomas. Now, Thomas is a collection of aphorisms. It's basically the results of a channeling session. And if you look at what was going on in Egypt at the time, that's essentially what they were doing. The Hermeticists, the Gnostics, these kind of groups, they certainly didn't have these names for themselves. They were all there in the Eastern Med, swapping ideas, reading these books that had just been translated into Greek. I mean, it was in Alexandria that the Old Testament was first translated into Greek. So all these ideas are washing around, and you have this Jesus figure that doesn't do anything physical in the Gospel of Thomas, but is instead the sort of originator of these aphorisms. And for me, if you go to a later one, say Gospel of Mary, my favorite piece of that kind of proves that it's a seance, where it's Peter saying, oh, why would the Son of God be talking to you, in reference to Mary, because she's a woman. And she cries and says, do you think I'm making all this up? Like, do you think this just comes out of my head? And, you know, that's a really odd conversation to have if Jesus is in the room. But if he's not in the room, what you're seeing there is a channeling session, and essentially a beef between channelers. I think when you throw that information into the sort of destruction of the physicalist Jesus story, you start to see that breaking that physicalist story literally redeems the world. Like, you now have access to what is probably the authentic Jesus. I don't think they ever expected anyone to believe these. How they use mythology and storytelling was it was objectively true. It just wasn't physical. And I think they would be really alarmed at the amount of people living today who are using these mystery stories as history. And if we put them back to mystery, then they work again. At least that's been my experience.
The one problem I see with that is sometimes we take that history and we elevate it to a level that it doesn't deserve. And I guess what I'm triggering off of there is, if you say it's a channeling session, well, I think channeling is very interesting, especially as a current phenomena that we can look at and say, you know, gee, there's some really bad channelers. You know, there's Jay-Z Knight who's channeling in front of her group of people and selling her Arabian horses for 10 times what they're worth because she says that they embody the spirit of some ancient, you know, Egyptian warrior and stuff, which is just clearly bullshit. But there's also seems to be channelers that are delivering meaningful, significant messages. We just did an interview, it hasn't been published yet, with Frank DeMarco, who has these amazing channeling sessions and done with in concert with the people at the Monroe Institute, and there seems to be a lot to it and all that. And yet at the same time, you read Frank's stuff and his conversations with the guys upstairs, and then you start picking apart his conception of Jesus is one of the things I picked apart, and his understanding of UFOs. And it's like, really? This is what the guys upstairs told you? And yet at the same time, much of it is very profound and very, you know, it seems enlightened. So when we say that the earliest books of the Bible, even the Gnostic Gospels, were channeled, I don't know what to do with that when I try and bring it into what I know about channeling from the people I'm studying in the here and now. I mean, it becomes a mess, but I think sometimes we kind of give it more credence than maybe we should.
I think the difference there is when we look at these texts in 2016, it's sort of like hearing about color on the radio. They were never intended to be finite. This is the definitive document that we kind of got a few centuries later when the Empire codified the book. Chris Knowles calls them fan fiction. That's essentially what was going on. The creation of these texts was an outpouring of other rituals. Every kind of digging season in Alexandria, there seems to be another wacky cult building that shows up. So you have Hermanibus in the same room as Jesus, and then there are psychedelic mushrooms painted on the wall of another one. We have to really, and I say this to occultists, if you do not understand magic unless you kind of know the street names of Alexandria. This is something that Europe only ever did once, or Eastern Med, because actually it's Africa, only ever did once. And they thought there was this civilizational project of connecting the planet's knowledge in a non-Google way of let's put together this wisdom. And we just cannot. There is no channeler today who is operating in that world with that access to thousands of people's, 10-hour hymns and staying up all night on mushrooms and fasting for 10 days in the desert. And they were really, talk about yoga, they're really pushing on it here. So,
I don't know if I quite agree with that. I think that's, I'm always a little bit skeptical when we romanticize different time periods in that way.
I don't know if that's romantic. I mean, I can send you the documents that have the actual mushrooms on the walls and so on. And if you look at where they're finding the codices, they're burying them in graveyards. These are magical objects that we can't conceive of how they were used. Not because the past was more advanced than us. It's because it's like hearing about color on the radio. We don't have the context for it.
I just think back about reading, one of the first yoga books I read, and everyone's read this book, is Autobiography of a Yogi, right? So you read the first 30 pages of it, and anyone who's in the magic occult world is like blown away. I mean, there's bilocation, there's rising of the dead, there's all these things. And we have basically there an unbroken tradition. We don't even know how far back it goes. So I do think we have records of this that correspond in a way, but in another way, make me call into question that, oh my gosh, the Egyptians, they really had it. They knew something, and then it was super secret and it was super lost. And now we don't know how to do anything because we're moderns, You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do, but that's not what I was saying. And in fact, Starship says the opposite. So, we cannot get our heads around how they lived. We can't get our heads around very successfully how the Victorian Londoners lived. When you're dealing with this kind of once in a culture moment, which gave the world multiple world religions, sort of allowed for the spread of quote unquote civilization, north, east, south, and west from there.
I have a problem with, that in the same way that Genghis Khan is in Europe, and he's just about ready. They're pillaging and just about ready to kick the can down the street a little bit further and just take over the whole damn thing. And hey, the Kublai Khan, the great Khan or whatever, dies. And, as tradition has it, everybody has to go back and has to do this big thing. History, I think, as we look at it through the rearview mirror, looks a lot different than it's lived. And I know you're in total agreement with that. But I think sometimes we slip into this mode of, this is the time period that spawned all these great religions. That's somebody will look back and say, with the advent of Mormonism, they'll say, hey, Mormonism was spawned during, this time or whatever. It's like, at the same time, Scientology was. Oh, isn't that a fantastic time? And us who lived through it will go, no, it was really kind of a bullshit time.
Yeah, I I don't think that's correct. Not for the sort of 500 BC to sort of 500 AD, where you have a universalizing of language. Yeah, like they had steam power. They had ships that had cargo carrying capacities that Europe didn't best for another 1,000 years. Like there are physical implements to prove that it was a very low probability kind of series of events that happened. Yeah, it's taken us a while to get back to some of them. But one of the other things that sort of emerged, and it kind of comes back to the question of the morality of the universe, is at the end of this period. So the Christian apologists probably weren't very sophisticated, but when you get to church fathers, some of them lied, obviously, you know, Eusebius lied if we're going back to the mythicist thing. But there are these debates coming out of sort of Alexandria and up the coast about how we do this, kind of what we're doing now. Is theurgy necessary? So is to have that Christ consciousness experience, or to have that encounter with the divine, can you just do it contemplatively or by reading books, or do you need theurgy? Do you need magic? Because this is what they were building. And they kind of didn't really settle on who won that, and then just had to change the laws 100 years afterwards. So I think they were doing Skeptico in 350 AD, which is quite impressive. Like, you know, Europe took 1,200 years off taking philosophy seriously fairly soon after that, and you know, there's something to it.
Definitely something to that. Wind us back if you can. Into Pieces of Eight.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it was on my first time in the show. I kind of consider people to have a healthy worldview if they are non-practicing magicians. So I think people who kind of really absorb the evidence that comes through something like Skeptico end up living in a universe where the miraculous doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. And in fact, the stuff that weird people out, like NDEs and visitations from deceased relatives and telepathy and all these things, you struggle to call them miraculous. I like that Dr. Kripal thing. They're not even supernatural. They're just natural. So the implications of that to me personally is that we can live in a world that is self-evidently quote-unquote magical. So magic is my umbrella term for looking at how all of these things and the UFO phenomenon and all the other stuff and kind of, you know, interventionism and ancient aliens and all that, how that all fits into a world where there is telepathy and spirits and an afterlife and so on. And that just, it looks like magic to me. That doesn't necessarily mean everyone has to kind of, you know, toddle off to the crossroads and start making pacts. It's that's a very, very niche, small amount of people. That's kind of where it's the difference between being a dentist and having teeth. I think everyone has teeth, but that's kind of where I think for Pieces of Eight, it's settled. And Chaos Magic's origin was in the 80s in the UK. It was essentially a rejection of a lot of that, well, all that thelemic nonsense and all the other stuff that kind of washed up into from the 70s with bizarre uses of astrology and kind of, you want to talk inside baseball, try and look at, you know, wizards arguing over minutiae of Golden Dawn or Thelemic texts in early 80s Britain. It's just, you know, a plague on both their houses. And it, nevertheless, underlying magic is the realization that the human mind can do these things. There are other things out there. And it's a question of kind of washing away a lot of the accretion and seeing what you can personally accrete around it afterwards.
You know, one other kind of passing thought that I'll bounce off you before we wrap this up. How do you understand technology in that? I think sometimes we have this kind of dualistic kind of view of, you know, oh, technology, it's in the material world. And I wonder if the lines aren't a little bit more blurred there than we understand them to be. What are some of your thoughts on advanced technology creeping into this area that we've cordoned off as the spirit world?
Well, I'll go even further. At the end of June this year, I gave a presentation at the London Occult Conference called Campfire's Edge, which people can find by logging into the member section of Rune Soup. And I don't think of technology as materialist at all. And in fact, its origins universally are something that had been given to us by the spirits or the demons. Whether you are in Africa, whether you're in Polynesia, wherever you have to be, there is something about our interaction with non-human entities that either increases or decreases technological complexity across time. That's kind of the thesis in the presentation. As for the shadow state weaponization of technology over the last 70 years, or at least since the end of World War II, I think, again, this is something that animism can do reasonably well, quite probably, which is dismiss that dualistic notion of the difference between, you know, the physical and the mind that we've got at this point in Western European culture's timelines, and go, well, this is probably the same thing. And yes, I don't know. I mean, consuming a mushroom is a technology. So if you have unlimited money and decades to work on some kind of psytronic weapon that can embed thoughts in people's mind that you've spent, you know, yeah, a lot of money building in an underground base, like, well, what's the difference there?
You know, it's funny because what really kind of crystallized that idea for me and brought it home is the movie. Have you ever seen the movie Embrace of the Serpent?
No, I haven't. I've got it on my I had it on my list in the UK, but you can't watch it in Australia. So I,
wow.
I'm currently looking for it. Yeah, it's just
you
release
can't
schedules.
Watch it in Australia. It's a terrific movie. And for those who haven't seen it, I too would highly recommend it. But there's this point where there's this shaman, living in the Amazonian rainforest. And there's this German explorer who comes, and it's this clash of shamanism and technology in some very interesting ways. But I thought, you know, you see a shaman in his younger years in full force, and then you see him as basically a broken man who is still a shaman, but is broken. And he's broken by technology. He's broken by the machete. He's broken by the crazy, out-of-control, capitalistic rubber farmers who chop people's arms off if they don't produce, you know, at the level that they should. And I thought, you know, here is again that theme of, you know, hey, shaman, what happened to your spirits here? This guy came in with a little bit of sharpened steel and bam, you know, it changed the whole thing. And it just made me kind of rethink, well, what do we really understand those boundaries to be between technology and the spirit world?
Well, I mean, I'm just thinking about how that would be conceptualized in a shamanic worldview. And it wouldn't, it's kind of very European to think it's a my gods is better than your gods. If you have an ecosystemic view, which presumably this shaman would have, then there are any number of reasons why his culture has collapsed that he can interpret within a spiritual world, like the spirits aren't pleased, or because they're amoral, not that interested in helping you, or it's just a thing like a steam train that happens at this point. And all these, this is where I think there's a maturity in the worldview rather than a, is this one better than that? If you mean, what does the presence of technology mean? What implications does it have when held up against practiced spirit technologies?
I was really taking it more, I think, in the same direction that you were, in that, you know, maybe we need to have a spiritually sensitive appreciation or thoughtfulness about technology, about where it comes from, where it goes, what it enables, where it ultimately might lead us. I mean, you look at EVP, you know, or you look at, yeah. I think it was Edison, primary interest was spirit communication, you know, and the technology that fell out of it was just like, oh, well, by the way, you know, technology falls out, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. That's where could have Campfire's Edge kind of lands on that, because you can wind it back to the the control of fire. The first mastery of fire is that story is one right. of spirits, and that is the first technology, essentially. From that, like, everything, every piece of technology is a child of fire. So it's literally technology emerges and increases and decreases in complexity according to the Campfire's Edge thesis as depending on things like spirit contact. This is they interrelate in very mysterious ways.
Well put. Gordon, thank you so much for joining me to talk about this book, Pieces of Eight, but more importantly, for indulging me with these somewhat random thoughts about these big, big picture issues. I knew if there was one guy I could lean on to kind of bare my soul and try and straighten my thinking out, it was you, and you've once again delivered. So it's been a great conversation. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, anytime, Mr. Securus. It was fantastic.
Thanks again to Gordon White for joining me today on Skeptico. Before I tee up a question from this interview, I did want to play a clip that I got on the Skeptico voicemail line. Remember, if you do have a comment on the show or an announcement to make, you can call into that line. I have a couple other ones queued up, but I think one per episode is enough. This one is from author and former guest who recently contacted me about this.
My name's Tim Freak. I'm a philosopher and the author of many books on the perennial philosophy and world spirituality. I'm wanting to let you know that one of my books, In the Light of Death, is now available free as an ebook. One of my great heroes, Socrates, said that the whole of philosophy is a meditation on death, and in many ways I think he's right. So this is a book which deals with my own experience around death and also a time in my life where I worked with people who were dying and bereaved. It explores some deep philosophical questions around death, and it's also a practical book for the dying and the bereaved, with some powerful meditations on death and how we live in the light of death.
So do check that out. I'll have a link in the show notes. And then back to the question that I might tee up from this interview. And it's the big one that we wrestled with in this show. And that is morality real? As Gordon framed it up, is morality a fundamental part of our universe? That's the question. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. Of course, the place to do it is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. You can jump on over to the forum. It's really easy to do. If you do join and make a post, I'll certainly read it. If you address it to me, I will almost certainly respond to it. So if you do want to connect with me, that's a great way to do it. You can also send me an email. There's many ways to connect if you'd like to do that, and I certainly hope you will. So I have a number of interesting shows coming up, some really good ones, I think, and I have many more that I'm scheduling on a wide variety of topics. If you're done with the religion thing for now, don't worry, we will move on eventually. So do please stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.